Fort Gibraltar and the Festival du Voyageur. And I'm talking with Colin Mackey, who is the Heritage Program Manager. And actually, I'm sort of leaning on the currency of the day, and the day being...
early 1800s.
Okay, I'm never good on numbers, Colin.
Well, neither am I. Okay.
The currency I'm talking about, of course, are one of two things that Europeans came to North America for. One was the cod, which, unfortunately, we've...
Well, no cod in Manitoba, that's for sure. But, out east.
And the other was Le Castor, the beaver. So, Colin, tell me about voyageurs. Who were they? What were they all about?
Well, voyageurs are pretty interesting characters. They were, generally speaking, young French-Canadian men from the Quebec, province of Quebec, then known as Lower Canada. And they were recruited by the Northwest Trading Company. Now, this is a fur trading company which was founded in Montreal and basically took up the old fur trade routes that the original French-Canadian explorers had discovered. Now, the Northwest Company, a very interesting company, led by Scottish men and businessmen who were looking to expand the reaches of basically their trading empire. Now, these voyageurs, incredibly hardworking men, generally fairly small men. They hired little guys so they didn't take up too much room in the boat. And basically what they would do is they would paddle canoes and paddle and paddle and paddle. So if you think of voyageurs in the modern context, I would think of them as the 19th century's truck drivers.
How about the Sherpas?
Yeah.
The Canadian West.
Sure, absolutely. I'd see that. And also voyageurs, once they had been in the business for many, many years, they started to learn the local languages of the First Nations. And they certainly, I would absolutely equate that with Sherpas, because they were the guides. They would know all hundreds of river systems throughout the Northwest to be able to transport these goods back and forth.
Right.
Now, there's actually two different categories of voyageurs. You've got the voyageurs that do the trip from Montreal on the St. Lawrence all the way to Fort William, which is at the very end of Lake Superior.
The Montreal men, I think they call it.
Les mangeurs de l'art, pork eaters.
Yeah. Pork eaters.
Pork eaters.
Yeah.
Now, they got good food. They got salt, pork, and peas, and all kinds of tasty
protein.
Stuff. Protein, that's right. But here in Winnipeg, at the forks of the Redness and Bone Rivers, we had the real voyageurs. We had les hommes du Nord, the Northmen. And these gentlemen, they weren't really gentlemen, these guys, they were paddling canoes from Fort William all the way up into the Athabasca district, and then later on even farther up to the Arctic Ocean, and eventually all the way out to the Pacific along the Columbia River. So these were incredibly hardworking guys, paddling 16 hours a day, generally moving canoes that are made out of birch bark. Mm-hmm. Approximately, les canaux du Nord, these are the ones for the northern routes. They're about 25 feet long. They carry about 2 tons worth of cargo.
Now, but they'd get coffee breaks every now and then, except it'd be pipe breaks.
It's a pipe, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you're expected to paddle about 60 strokes a minute.
Yeah.
And every 50 minutes, you get a 10-minute break to have a pipe. So you can sort of relax in between your travels, although those pipes and those paddling expeditions can be broken up by portages. Now, a portage is where you actually have to take everything out of the canoe, carry the canoe over land, and carry all your goods. Well, voyageurs were expected to carry at least 2 90-pound bales on their back. So that's 180 pounds on your back. And these portages can be anywhere up to 5 kilometers long. So these are pretty much back-breaking treks with a huge amount of weight on your back. But it's all for the furs. It's all in order for...
All for the beaver. All for Le Castor. Why, Le Castor, why did this fur, luxurious fur, become such a commodity on a world market?
Well, there was an incredible fashion for hats. Europeans really liked felt hats, beaver felt hats in particular. And the beaver felt, beaver does make a beautiful, luxurious felt. Basically, what you have to do is there's two types of fur on each beaver pelt. You've got a longer fur, which is, or hair, that's a guard hair, actually, and this helps to keep lots of air against the animal's skin so it can keep warm in the winter. But underneath that, you have an amazingly soft down.
Right.
And that down can be shaved off the hide, mixed together with all kinds of different chemicals and dyes, and then using heat and pressure and steam, you can rub it together and you can make the most amazing felt. And that gets pressed into hats and forms and makes top hats.
Yeah.
So we're here in Canada as a nation because of top hats.
And European colonial powers, Great Britain in this case, commercial enterprise for a natural resource, not oil, not gold, an animal.
Yeah.
All for hats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you make money out of hats?
Well, it's an interesting story, you know, and if you were talking about global economies, the beaver pelts, one of the reasons that they needed to expand the fur trade in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries is because most of Siberia had been trapped out. So there was an expansionist movement to go across to the New World and discover new furs. But it's interesting, the beaver pelts would be shipped back to London from Montreal, and then from London they'd be shipped back to Siberia where they'd be made into hats, then shipped back to London, and if you wanted to buy a hat here in Winnipeg, it would have to be shipped from London to here again. So you've got a beaver that comes from the Red River, gets shipped to London, shipped to Russia, made into a hat, then shipped back to London, and shipped back here as a hat.
Everything old is new again.
Everything old is new again, yeah.
Depleting natural resources, finding new natural resources, outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking one of the first multinational corporations.
Absolutely. In fact, we have two multinationals at work in the 19th century here.
In competition in Canada.
Intense competition. This is extreme competition, that being the Northwest Company, as I mentioned before, and the older and much more powerful Hudson's Bay Company, which is actually still in existence today.
HBC.
The HBC.
Or the Bay.
Or as some scholars even call it, the Here Before Christ, because it's such an old, old company. Founded May 2nd, 1670, in London. Really, its main job was to find furs and control the territory of land that drains into the Hudson's Bay.
Now, did both those companies have a royal charter?
No, the Northwest Company did not have a royal charter.
It was strictly a private corporation.
It was a consortium of businessmen, essentially.
Scottish elite.
Yeah, the Scots really took over the economic classes of Montreal after La Conquête. So after the fall of New France, you've got this huge economic movement moving into Montreal, especially taking over all of these.
Okay.
You know, the base industry for that territory was absolutely the fur trade. They're basically
so you've got two main players in a new world economy,
mm-hmm.
Struggling for dominance, but struggling for to control the monopoly.
Absolutely.
And what happened to the Northwest Company?
That's a long answer question. I would say one of the reasons that we here at the Festival de Voyageur have such a wealth of resources to talk about in terms of historical thematics and what have you is here in Winnipeg you really start to see the movement towards consolidating the fur trade. You have the Northwest Company in tight competition with the Hudson's Bay Company. The Hudson's Bay Company, with its main backer, Lord Selkirk, established Lord Selkirk Colony, or the Red River Settlement, here in Red River in the year 1812. Now this actually colonial effort really started to irk the Northwest Company quite a bit, because all of a sudden you have all of these interlopers, or rather these colonists arriving, who are starting to disrupt your trade. This is a very large problem. And this led to open conflict across the Northwest. You'd have, it's almost like an arms race. You have one fort by the Northwest Company on one side of the river, and you got a Hudson's Bay Company post on the other side of the river. And, of course, there would be shots fired, and everyone screaming at everyone else. And a lot of these things went back to old clan rivalries as well, back to the Highlands of Scotland. I mean, it's the ancient war that just sort of spilled over here in the backdrop of, economic expansionism. So,
and the largest free trade zones on the planet at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
So this is long before NAFTA.
No, yes, long before NAFTA. The Beaver Free Trade Agreement. No.
Okay.
So you've got, these huge companies competing against each other, opposing interests, and open conflict. And this is kind of unacceptable to a lot of the people back home in England.
What are the contemporary lessons of the voyageur and the fur trade? What would economists or MBAs learn from those days?
I'm not sure that they've learned very much.
Okay.
Telling the truth, I mean, I think that it's happening all over again. We have
plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
Exactement.
Everything old is new again.
Old all over again. So, we have companies importing goods from around the world. They're finding cheap labor here in Canada on the backs of the First Nations people. I mean, there's another misconception that Europeans were going out and doing all this trapping.
Right.
No, no, no. Europeans not good at that. I'm European in background, and we were no good at surviving in the wintertime. We wouldn't live if it hadn't been for those native people who basically helped them survive and helped them use the resources that were on the land, essentially. And also, these are the people who are going out and trapping all of their furs. So these are the ones who are actually capturing those economic resources, that gold that they were looking for in terms of fur.
Well, what are the political issues?
Ooh, there's lots of political issues. You mentioned free trade. We've got colonialism, the whole debate about, cultural pollution and changing,
cultural when cultures collide, I think is the expression we use it too.
Absolutely, and I mean, I'm forced to take a Marxist perspective at looking at this because a lot of this is driven by social classes. I mean, you've got the strata of classes working here at this fort alone are quite interesting. I mean, you've got the voyageurs who are at the bottom. I mean, these guys are workers and laborers, and they were essentially driven through the need to find some kind of income. To work and work hard for years of backbreaking labor. And then on top of that, you've got trained men who have some degree of literacy, like carpenters and blacksmiths and coopers and canoe makers and men like that. Then on top of that, you have the sons of the gentlemen in the area. So these guys would be the clerks who work in the fort. So these gentlemen are young, 14, 15, learning the trade. And then on top of that, you've got, and this is especially Marxist, because they used to call the boss of the fort le bourgeois.
Right.
And le bourgeois is the partner or proprietor of the fort. So,
tell me about why, for example, well, first of all, why would you give a company a royal charter to go out and set up a business enterprise in a land that doesn't really belong to you? Why would a private concern do the same thing? What are the implications of that?
Well, I think money is the main idea here.
So much for historic or romantic Canadian history.
Exactly. Well, I think certainly there's some notion of romance behind the men who are working there, but the guys who are setting it up, the Hudson's Bay Company in particular, is formed in the 17th century, and in that period you see the founding of a number of chartered companies that are essentially going out overseas to establish themselves. You know, Great Britain at this time was changing rapidly. I mean, they were developing their navy to really incorporate a mercantilist ideal of global economy. I mean, they were building ships to travel the world. They realized we're an island.
They're building an empire.
Building an empire, exactly. Precisely.
Okay. So, and you establish colonies in various ways. You either send out your soldiers to establish a colony, or who else you send out?
Well, you send out your businessmen. You send out your les hommes d'affaires, the men who are going to go set up these organizations and these companies that will eventually control that territory. See, here in Canada, when they founded the Hudson's Bay Company, you already have almost 100 years of European settlement along the St. Lawrence River and in Atlantic Canada, but in the West, it was a vast, unknown territory.
Yeah.
The two gentlemen that led to the creation of the Hudson's Bay Company, Radisson and de Grosselier, these guys were French Canadians.
Right, they also opened a big hotel chain, too.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
And one of them did.
Yeah, that's right. And, he's an interesting character. But, yeah. I mean, they had some notion of northern Canada and what that could be. How that could be exploited and used for the economic benefit of France at first, but they didn't want to hear anything about it. So they went over to England, and they managed to get involved in the coffee house culture of the time, which is where all the big business transactions were going on. And there, through hook or by crook, they managed to meet up with Prince Rupert of the Rhine. Prince Rupert, a fascinating character. He was a hero of the British Civil War. Of course, he was fighting for the royalist side, so he had to leave for a little while there. But by our time period, by the 1660s, 1670s, he's back in England. He's an inventor, a scholar, metallurgist, all kinds of interesting factors, and he's, of course, extremely rich, and happens to be cousin to King Charles II of England. So anyways, they get, Radisson de Gracia, get mixed up with Prince Rupert, and then, of course, petition him to petition his cousin, the king, to found the company. So even then, you've got, you know, power structures at work, where the upper class work with the upper class to create a company. So
that's, and it was, at one point in time, the area was called Rupert's Land.
Rupert's Land, exactly, after Prince Rupert. He was the first governor of the Hudson's Bay Company.
One last question. I used to make a joke that how do you tell a Canadian from everybody else? Well, you know, the Americans have the eagle, the Brits have the lion, mm-hmm. the Russians have the bear, and we have the beaver. The
very
cute little hard-working,
noble creature.
Great dental hygiene. You know, can build a house anywhere.
Anywhere, yeah.
But don't mess with us or we'll flood you out.
That's right.
Absolutely,
okay. Yeah.
So, great discussion. A lot of issues here, though.
Mm-hmm.
That this isn't just cute history. This isn't just, as we said, romantic, nice history.
No.
A lot of heavy-duty issues in terms of the fur trade and the voyageur.
Absolutely. I would agree with that entirely. I think as North Americans, as Canadians, we often think that, well, you know, our history is not too interesting because it's not very old. Well, we stem from this amazing movement that changed the world in Europe. Expansionism and colonialism changed the scope of the globe, really, and that's where we come from. That's our background. So I think that we need to explore that more. And the fur trade and that those roots of the Canadian nation are essential in that story.
Thank you very much, Colin.
You're very welcome.